Hello and welcome to the Mariner's Library with me, Chris Stanmore-Major. In this episode, we're continuing the book The Venturesome Voyages of Captain Voss by Captain J.C. Voss. We're on the second book, we're on the 13th chapter, and this is the 12th part of the reading. And if you haven't already, please consider going over to patreon.com/themariner, and there for $5 a month you can help support this podcast and keep the information contained within these fantastic books easily available for the next generation. Now on with the story. Chapter 13, A Lawsuit. The contract which I had made with the manager of the carrier company was a verbal one only. However, I had informed that gentleman of the weight of my boat and also told him that she held the world's record for the only real canoe and the smallest vessel that ever crossed the Pacific Ocean. I had pointed out the fact that the Tillicum constituted my home and my existence, and as I considered her of great value to me, I had urged him to employ the greatest care and good gear to avoid possible accidents, whereupon the manager had assured me that he would use the best appliances and that nothing would happen to my boat, and I had taken his promise as a guarantee. The manager was not present when the unfortunate smash-up occurred, but I at once sent for him, not allowing anybody to touch the boat until after his arrival. I then asked the man whether he would be good enough to have the Tillicum repaired under my instruction, and whether she proves seaworthy or not, I said, we will call it square. "Captain," he answered, "I am very sorry. It is rather a sad accident, but I don't think I can do anything for you." "Mr. X," I refrained from mentioning the name for obvious reasons, I said, "you will excuse me for correcting you. The breaking up of my boat was not an accident, but due to carelessness on your part. I repeat my offer. If you repair the boat under my instructions, I will call it square and say no more about it." Mr. X promised to send a carpenter, who came the next day. He offered to repair the boat for £22.10. Mr. X now proposed to pay half of this sum on condition that I contributed the other half. But the carpenter acted in a way which gave me some reason to doubt his ability to restore my little vessel to a seaworthy condition. Therefore, I asked Mr. X to send another man of more experience, to which he agreed. The following day, the new man arrived to examine the boat. He was of middle age, and I could see at once that he knew his business, so I wished that Mr. X would entrust him with the job. However, as he asked £37 for repairing the boat, Mr. X refused him and adhered to the original proposal. As I would not accept that, a lawsuit followed, which kept me in Melbourne for several months longer than my programme provided for. I was, of course, a perfect stranger in Melbourne, with the exception of a few friends whom I had made during my short stay. On the other hand, the firm with which I was to go to law had the reputation of being the largest truck and dray company in the city, and were very wealthy. When it had become known, therefore, that I had sued the firm for damages, people advised me not to appeal to law, for the company would prove too strong for me and that they would be sure to win eventually at my expense. Others came forward and even offered to pay for the repairs to my boat. In short, when I got into that trouble, I discovered that I had a good many more friends than I had supposed. However, I declined all assistance, knowing from personal experience that British jurisdiction is fair for rich and poor alike, everyone getting his deserts. I therefore took the advice of Mr. C. McLaughlin, a member of the St. Kilda Yacht Club, at whose house I was staying, and went to see Mr. W. Walcott, a Melbourne solicitor. After having stated my case, Mr. Walcott assured me that my claims were substantial, and consequently did not hesitate to file a suit for damages amounting to £500. I told Mr. Walcott that I considered the sum to be excessive, inasmuch as I only wanted my boat restored to a sound condition. But he pointed out that I would have to suffer a loss of time amounting to 3 months until the court sat, and that the delay might even exceed that time. Mr. J. E. Smith, a building inspector and Canadian by birth, had, ever since my arrival at Melbourne, shown great interest in my voyage. He said he would like to see me complete the cruise, and was kind enough to offer me a vacant plot near his home to put my boat in order. This I accepted, and as I wanted to be near the Tillicum, I likewise took advantage of Mr. and Mrs. Smith's generous invitation to stay with them as a guest until the case should be decided in court. The people of Melbourne, having treated me so hospitably, I naturally disliked the idea of taking action against a Melbourne firm. However, as my cause was just and I was advised by my new friends and the solicitor to go ahead, steps were taken and the case was called in the Melbourne County Court. The day came, and I was present with Mr. Walcott and my barrister, Mr. MacArthur, when the court opened. There were three breach of promise cases ahead of mine, and they were settled in about 2 hours. I consequently thought that in another hour or two I should have my verdict, but in this case I was very much mistaken, as my case required 7 days in all. And because it took such a long time, it may be interesting to the reader to learn the most important points on which I won and Mr. X lost. The defendant's lawyer took me under a crossfire which lasted nearly one whole day, but it only served to prove that practically the sole point of importance was the hook which broke and thus caused all the trouble. The lawyer asked me what I thought of the hook, to which I replied that it was no good. This seemed to upset the temper of my questioner, and he eventually thought that he had already cornered me. He looked at me and then at the judge and uttered in a harsh tone, "Your opinion is that the hook was no good, but what will you say when Professor Kernow, who is an authority on iron and steel manufacture, will stand where you are now and declare under an oath that the hook in question was made of the very best Swedish iron?" Professor Kernow was considered the most prominent expert on iron and steel in Australia at that time, and he served as a witness to Mr. X. I answered that in such a case, I still would uphold what I had stated, viz. That the hook was no good. Then the lawyer looked at me and said, "You are a most wonderful man." At this juncture, the judge intervened and asked me to explain why the hook was no good. My contention was on these lines. To begin with, the iron of which the hook was made was probably good Swedish iron before it was shaped into the hook. But the blacksmith who manufactured the hook made a mistake, inasmuch as all hooks should be forged out of one single and solid piece of stock. In this case, the eye and the hook proper have been made each separately, and then the two pieces were welded together at what is called the neck of the hook. Besides, as the fracture plainly shows, there existed at the inner side of the neck, where the welding was done, a flaw about 1/16 of an inch deep, which extended halfway round the hook to the outside. And the brittle condition of the iron at the outer neck leaves no doubt that in welding, the material had been overheated. In other words, the iron, through being overheated, became similar to cast iron. For when the hook broke, instead of straightening out at first before reaching the breaking point, as it would have done under normal circumstances, it snapped like a piece of glass. Consequently, though good Swedish iron might have been employed, it was ruined through poor workmanship, leaving the finished hook unreliable and unsafe to use. Whereupon I produced the lower end of the hook to corroborate my statement. The next man in the box was Mr. X, and like myself, he was kept there for the best part of a day, being cross-examined by my lawyer. The agreement between Mr. X and myself with regard to moving the boat had been a verbal one only, as stated above, but in his evidence he acknowledged, which of course was bare truth, what I had said when accepting his tender for moving my boat, to wit, the weight of the boat was about £3,000, that he should be sure to employ good gear in order to avoid accidents, and that the Tillicum was my home and means of livelihood. I do not think that Mr. X treated me altogether properly when he refused to repair the boat, but he certainly proved himself a gentleman when acknowledging the above statement before the judge and jury. The next to bear witness, also on behalf of Mr. X, was the carpenter, who had offered to repair the boat for £37. Here I must premise that the three shear legs, which were used for hoisting the boat off and on the wagon, belonged to myself, and I had purchased them in Melbourne for this purpose. I had also supervised the moving operations, as already mentioned. The carpenter's evidence ran as follows. To lift any kind of heavy weight, two shear legs, stayed by means of guy rope, fastened to the top, should be used instead of three shear legs, as employed on this occasion. Three shear legs, the witness claimed, were good enough to lift a few bags of potatoes or coal, but would never do for raising a heavy load, as they would shack and swing about when the strain was applied. This witness claimed to be a shipbuilder. The judge, who seemed much surprised at his statement, asked him what he was talking about. As to myself, having been previously informed of the evidence that was to be brought forward against me, I was prepared to meet the occasion. I had made 3 quarter-inch square sticks, 2 feet long, and to prove my actual demonstration that the witness was altogether wrong, with permission of the judge, I placed 2 of the sticks on a board like 2 shear legs, with a stay fastened to the top, just as the witness had described it. I then hung a small spring scale to the top of the 2 shear legs and slowly pulled it down. When the shear legs came to a breaking strain, the spring scale indicated 6 pounds. I then placed the 3rd leg in position, removing the stay rope, and without altering the angle of the first 2 shear legs, now the shear legs would come to a breaking strain when the scale showed 14 pounds. Mr. MacArthur then told the shipbuilder that that was all he wanted from him. The next witness for Mr. X was Professor Curnow, and like the rest of the chief witnesses, he was kept under direct cross-examination for the best part of a day. However, the gist of his evidence was that he had tested the lower hook of the tackle, which did not break, and had ascertained a breaking strain of nearly 4 tons. He also stated that the hook was made of good iron. The professor further admitted the existence of the flaw in the broken hook. When all the evidence was gathered, I requested Mr. MacArthur to put it to Professor Curnow whether he would or would not use a hook like the one in question when about to lift a heavy and valuable load, to which he replied that he would not. In giving that answer, Professor Curnow certainly confirmed my statement that the hook used with the tackle was inefficient. Several other witnesses were examined whose evidence had less importance. The case having been summed up, the jury retired, and when returning about half an hour later, judgment was given in my favour for £200 and costs. Mr. X intended to appeal, but in order to avoid further loss of time, I came to a private agreement with him. Thus, the trouble was settled. Chapter 14. Repairing a Wreck, an Overland Haul, and with an intoxicated crew off for Adelaide. Meantime, the Tillicum lay at the vacant lot with all her bones broken, and by looking at her, no one would have thought that she was good for anything but firewood. However, I did not abandon the idea that I would be able to fix her up and complete my voyage in her to London, and as I have some experience with tools, being a bit of a wood spoiler myself, I went to work to put her together and see her floating once again. The first thing I did was to place the wreckage on blocks. I proceeded to screw here and there and all around until the boat had assumed its former shape. I then laid ropes all round and by means of Spanish windlasses tightened them. In this way I gradually closed the splits and brought all pieces together in their proper places. Thereupon I applied thin steel ribs from one end to the other, fastening the same with screw bolts driven from the outside and set up with a nut inside. When I had all the steel ribs and bolts in place, I removed the ropes and put a new keel under her. I then corked all the splits and fractures and finally put the fittings back in their respective places. After I had applied 2 coats of paint inside and out, the Tillicum looked almost as well as when I had left Victoria. The only difference was that, with the exception of the top work, not a split or seam could be seen in her when I set out, for she had not suffered as much as a scratch all the way to Melbourne. Now I had but a patched-up canoe. However, I decided to give her another trial, and if she would stand the test, I was to proceed on my voyage. During my stay in Melbourne, I met people from Ballarat, an important mining town with a population of about 40,000, situated at a distance of approximately 100 miles from Melbourne. They asked me to bring my boat to their city. As I was desirous of seeing a little of the interior of Australia, I went up to Ballarat by train via Geelong. Quite a surprise was in store for me on my arrival, for I had no idea that such a fine city existed in the interior. The main street compares favourably with any I have seen in other parts of the world. There is a reason for this, as Ballarat is surrounded by some of the best farming country found anywhere, besides being a great mining centre. It also derives fame from the fact that it is the only place in Australia where a battle between Europeans was fought. If I am not mistaken, this happened about 1849, when miners came into conflict with the police. Just outside Ballarat is a fine park, the centre of which is occupied by a beautiful lake about a mile across. The view of this lake, surrounded by splendid trees and flowers of every description and covered with pleasure boats and yachts, with the bright sun shining over all, reminded me of Penryn Island and its lagoon. On that bright sheet of water, enlivened by all the splendour of a regatta day, I sailed the Tillicum among a crowd of yachts and pleasure boats. Proudly, she carried her new suit of sails, which was presented by the Ballarat yachtsman, and the people told me that she was the first deep-sea vessel to ever sail on their lake. My next move was to Geelong, where the Tillicum re-entered the Briny. I was in need of a new mate, and several young Ballarat men had offered their services. After I'd picked one of the number, I took him to the mayor to have him signed on for the trip to London. The mayor of Ballarat, who had held that office for a good many years, was about 65 years of age, and the people looked upon him as a father. He told me, with tears in his eyes, that one of his sons had taken to the sea and was lost, and he warned the young man to be careful. But when I had assured the old gentleman that after the accident which had befallen me, I always made sure that a lifeline was used, he seemed to feel more satisfied. It was a day or two later that I took the Tillicum down to Geelong and put her in the water. When everything was ready, a good strong breeze was blowing, which turned up a short, choppy sea. This gave me an excellent opportunity for a trial, and I went out sailing, accompanied by some of the Geelong yachts. I forced the boat as much as she could stand under all sail, and sometimes put her bow clean under water. However, the trial proved successful, as I could discover no sign of a leak. The only mischief that was done was the upsetting of my new mate's stomach, but I consoled him somewhat with the assurance that in a day or two he would get over that. At nightfall, we anchored alongside the Geelong Wharf again, and after advising my mate that we should set sail the next morning at daybreak, I went on shore to bid goodbye to some friends. When I returned to the boat next morning, my mate was missing, and I have not seen him since. I at once wired to the Seaman's Home at Melbourne for another man, and the following morning, while I stood on the wharf awaiting the arrival of my companion, I noticed a man walking towards me with a bag of clothes on his shoulder. He was very much intoxicated to my appearance, and at times the bag would overbalance him, and both bag and owner fell heavily to the ground. However, he managed to regain his feet each time, and by and by came near me. Then the fellow dropped his bag and said that he had just arrived from Melbourne and was going to join a vessel. He pointed at the same time to a bark which lay at anchor about 300 yards distant. He showed me a letter which he said was addressed to the captain of the vessel he was hired for. I looked at it and saw my own name written thereupon, and I knew at once that he was to be my mate. He then queried whether that was my boat lying alongside the wharf. I replied in the affirmative and added that it was the vessel he would go on. He was like all other men when they were intoxicated, full of arguments and foolish talk, and after some dispute, I finally got him on board and he soon fell asleep in the cabin. I set all sail and, losing no more time, took my departure for Adelaide. It was about 4 o'clock when the Tillicum, with a light easterly breeze, was gliding down Port Phillip Bay towards the ocean, but at sunset the wind lightened and so I dropped anchor for the night. My new mate was still sound asleep, in which condition he continued until the next morning at daybreak. When I got up and gave him a call, he exhibited great surprise. He stared at me and looked out on deck and asked, "Where am I?" "You're on board the Tillicum and bound for Shanghai," I replied. "Holy smoke, Shanghai and bound for Shanghai?" the newcomer uttered. When I had explained matters to him and what kind of job he had undertaken, he was not quite so dismayed. Only he felt very bad, he said, and would give anything for a drink. But as his bottle was empty and I had no liquor of any kind on board, I told him that a good draught of water was the best drink he could take to restore himself. We then got our anchor up and headed once more for the open sea. About midday, we sailed through the entrance of Port Phillip Bay and shaped a course along the coast for Port Adelaide, a distance of about 500 miles. When my new mate had sobered up, he proved himself first-class seaman. The wind was variable and moderate all the way, and nothing unusual happened during the trip. On the sixth day out, we were becalmed near Kangaroo Island and anchored there for the night. The next morning, a light breeze blew from the southwest and we sailed with it up to Port Adelaide. There the Tilikum again was taken ashore and conveyed to the city of Adelaide, the capital of South Australia, where I stopped till December the 28th. Thereafter, I removed the boat to Glenel, a summer and pleasure resort 8 miles outside of Adelaide. My mate was greatly addicted to alcoholic drinks, and I was obliged, therefore, to engage another man. When he was found, I sailed from Glenel on January the 4th, 1903, for Hobart, Tasmania, a distance of about 800 miles, which was made in 13 days with variable winds and good weather. The night before, I was honoured with a banquet given by the Glenel yachtsmen who, when leaving, accompanied the Tilikum for some distance in their yachts. On arrival at Hobart, my new mate from Adelaide assured me that he had enjoyed the trip immensely and that he would like to accompany me to London in the Tilikum. His name was Ed O'Donner, but he was better known as the Tattooed Man of Australia, being tattooed all over his body. He was a good entertainer and knew how to while away the time pleasantly. Well, that's all for today. I hope you're enjoying the story so far. The next instalment will be available in the Mariner's Library shortly. And remember, of course, you've got all the content over on YouTube and the Mariner podcast, and of course, Patreon at patreon.com/themariner. But for now, wherever you are and whatever you're doing, I hope that you're safe and sound, and I look forward to speaking to you in the next one. Cheers.